Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming out to the Poison Pen Bookstore. It's great to see people live and in person again after all this time. It's always a treat and a tradition that we haven't been able to do the last couple of years to welcome our good friend Isabella Maldonado back to the store to celebrate her brand new book, The Falcon. Please help me give her. Yeah. Always great to have you, you know, and in style. Did you show everybody your, well, they can't see it, but
no.
Her nails are super cool.
Yeah, I did. I'm always typing all the time, and so I have to keep my nails short, and so I thought, well, I'm celebrating. We have a new book out, so I got my nails done with a picture of the book on them.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah, it's very great, fancy.
I got some great pictures in the back.
It's not good for typing, but it's really cool.
Now, how many of you have read books 1 and 2 or both of the Nina Guerrero series? Just about everybody. A few that haven't. You can see my indecipherable notes. There's a lot of stuff I would like to get into.
Yeah.
But we're very careful because this is a book that we can't give away too many spoilers.
Yeah.
And there's if you know how she writes, you know, there's a lot of twists and turns and action and adventure. And so I'm going to be very careful not to give away spoilers. For the people who haven't read books 1 and 2, can you give us just a little bit of backstory about Nina and her world and where she comes from?
Yeah, in the first book, In the Cipher, you meet Nina Guerrera, which means warrior girl. And when you meet her, you realize she's a trauma survivor. She has a very traumatic background. And as she has grown up in the foster system, she didn't know who her family was. She was attacked and by a serial killer, but she managed to get away, and she's the only one who ever managed to get away. She was only 16 years old at the time, and then she fights off attackers in the park. The video of the attack goes viral, and then he rediscovers her. She's changed her name, she's now grown up, she's become an FBI agent after being a police officer, but he finds her, and he wants to now track her down and finish what he started, and merriment ensues.
Right. So she's now an FBI agent, and she's discovered that her biological parents have passed away. This isn't too much of a spoiler, but that she has relatives here in Phoenix. And so it's nice to get the series back here into our town.
Yes, I know. I managed it.
Right. And so tell us a little bit about, before we get into The Falcon, can you kind of set up book 2 a little bit?
Yes.
What happens previously?
Yes. So in book 1, we start off, she's detailed over to the FBI's behavioral analysis unit. And that is actually, everyone thinks it's in Quantico because of the TV shows and such, but really it's just outside of Quantico. It's been moved to a location in Aquia that's just outside of there, but it's very close. And so she's working with them, and so that's what starts off in the very beginning. And there are several different cases that take place all over the country, and they go around solving them. And then in book 2, it's like we get to know kind of who she is in book 1, and we learn that some things about her. And then in book 2, she actually is able to find her biological family and meets them, and it turns out they're in Phoenix. And so it's kind of fun. She gets to experience what it's like, and for someone who's grown up never having a family, never feeling like she was wanted, never feeling like she was loved, it was really sort of a very heartfelt thing for her to be able to discover that. And while they're at it, it's kind of funny, I like to talk about her character arc, but in reality, there's a very difficult case that they're trying to solve. And in book 2, it's a leap year killer. It's someone who kills only on leap day. So one time every 4 years, he commits a multiple homicide. And it sort of reminds everyone of the legend of La Llorona. And so we understand who La Llorona is and how that relates to this case. And it was fun to talk about that.
Right. Now, there's something very specific that brings her back to town in this book.
Mm-hmm.
There's a case going on. Can you talk a little bit about happening?
I can. Actually, you know, before I even get to that, I just found out yesterday I got an email that the second book, Different Dawn, just it won an International Latino Book Award.
Oh,
so
wow.
So it's really, really
That's
cool.
Awesome.
Yeah, very cool. That book has a lot of more of the Latino culture in it than, you know, than the first book did.
Right.
You know? So that was one there. So I don't know whether it's gold, silver, or bronze, but it won one of the three, and then they'll make the announcement in Los Angeles in August, I believe it is, to know which level of award it. But it did win one of them. So that made my heart happy.
Absolutely.
And so now we're in Phoenix, and what has brought Nina and her team back to Phoenix is their a bunch of different mysterious disappearances of co-eds at a campus called AIT, which stands for the Arizona Institute of Technology. And no, it doesn't exist, so you can't try to go there. But basically, it's like it's a very, very elite tech school. So, you know, think of like MIT, or think of the, you know, Caltech. It's like on a par with those. So it's a very, very elite tech university like that, and it's I said it in Phoenix, and even though the university itself is fictional, all of the area around it is very real, and so it's got very specific things going on. And so as these girls disappear, they're called in because they're here at the end of the other case anyway, and so they call in and they're like, we need some help because this is bizarre and we don't know where they're vanishing to. We don't know what's going on. So yeah, they have to deal with this.
And I wanted to, you know, I remember last time we spoke, these books, although, you know, Nina's definitely the protagonist, these are real, it's a real team effort with these books.
Yeah.
And that you need to get this FBI team. And I thought maybe just for fun, I'd have you kind of just basically outline who's on the team, and they all bring us very specific skill sets to this case.
They do. They do. And actually, I found out that each of the team members is getting their own fan club. It's really kind of funny. They, you know, people have written to me, and they're, you know, they love certain members of the team. So that makes me feel good. Like I'm writing people that are very realistic, and a lot of them are sort of based on people in law enforcement that. Not specific individuals, but based on kind of, you know, like a general type of law enforcement. And one of them is Wade. He is the senior FBI profiler. And what I wanted to show with him, you know, he's in his 50s, he's been around a long time, but I remember when I was at the FBI National Academy in Quantico, and I was taking some courses there, and they were showing us, the behavioral profilers were showing us cases, and they were talking about the strain that it put on them, because they would have to not only investigate the case, but they would put themselves into the mind of the suspect, and they would put themselves into the mind of the victim in order to understand each case. And you do that enough times, and it puts a kind of dark stain on your soul. And they talked about this, about the hard, difficult thing that it is to do. And some of them, their marriages would suffer sometimes, their own mental health would suffer sometimes, they would have to take a break, you know. But in general, they were so strong, and they would do this, and they were willing to sort of journey into the darkest places of the human mind so that we could get people off the street, like serial killers who needed to be off the street. So Wade is kind of my respect for that kind of person, and he's a very tortured soul, and he's been to hell and back, and you can tell, and he's had his own regrets with cases that he's done. So that's you know, what he represents. And then another one is Kent. He is a former Navy SEAL, and he is someone who he's able to get involved with the cases, and he uses his background and his training that he has learned and hard won. And I, especially in this new book, In the Falcon, I make it quite clear that he has his own scars. He has physical scars and he has emotional scars, and they are because of everything he went through. He's been captured. I don't spell it all out, but as you read, you understand he's been through his own kind of trauma from being in combat and being, you know,
right.
taken prisoner and stuff. So, but he has a lot of, he does a lot of linguistics and his own studies, and he's had a lot of psychology and things like that. And then there's Breck, who has her own fan club too. People have told me they would love to see a spinoff with Breck. She is, I had fun writing her. She's a cybercrime specialist, and I had fun writing her because it was like, okay, what is the last person you would think of if you would think of a computer nerd? And that was Breck. You know, she's a Southern belle. She's very pretty. She's, you know, super smart, obviously, but she just has this sort of sweetness about her. But yes, she's kind of sassy at the same time. She's got a lot of that Southern charm, but also attitude. And I have a lot of fun writing her because, you know, growing up, I knew a lot of people from all over the South and spent a lot of time there. And they have a way of talking that just, it cracks me up. I love Southern people talking, and I just had to put all those kind of expressions and stuff like that. So it gives her a lot of flavor that you like. And then, of course, Bianca
right.
is, she's another fan favorite. Many people have told me they'd love to see her have her own series or something like that. So she is, she just turned 18, but she's a genius. So she's already finished her undergraduate degree, and she's looking to where she's going to go to grad school, because she went to university at 14. So, you know, so it's really a challenge to write someone like her, because she doesn't think like everybody else.
Right.
And that is kind of hard to do. But she definitely has that fun, you know, sort of teenage attitude that you get, you know, when you're like, you're the smartest person in the room, and
yeah.
you're 18 years old, and you know it.
right.
But she's a lot of fun, though, because she's the kind of person that wouldn't take anybody's crap.
Yeah.
She just wouldn't.
Well, and you tell us, you know, how, can you maybe explain to them how she came into Nina's life?
Yeah, actually, that's the opening chapter. And one of the things that I've done, and this is unique to this series, I don't do it with my other series. In this series, each book I open with, it's kind of like a prologue, but I call it chapter one, you know. So in the first book, in the prologue, you learn who Nina is and where she came from and her traumatic backstory. And then in the second book, you learn a little bit more about Nina's backstory. In the third book, you learn how Nina met Bianca and why Bianca is so important to her. And it was just really important to spell that out so that you'd understand, you know, and also a little bit of why Bianca has such an attitude, too.
Right.
I mean, you understand that more because
Absolutely.
You're like, you know, she had a hard life, too.
Right.
So.
Yeah. How many people here are in law enforcement have a background?
Go ahead.
They're not
going to raise
their hand. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe I should be asking all of you this question too. There's an awful lot of tech in the book, in this book, and it seems like how do you keep up? How do you keep up with what's going on?
Yeah, it's I tell you, it is very challenging because I retired several years ago.
Yeah.
As I think all of us are retired from law enforcement at this point who are in the room. But yeah, I retired several years ago, and it is true that your skills do, that the technology just really continues on. My last position that I had, I was the commander of special investigations and forensics. And so you'd think, oh, that's great. You can write all this, you know, really cool forensic stuff. Well, that stuff, I mean, that I knew is
yeah.
just like, we've gone, I have to continuously learn and re-educate. I interview people and I go to training. Some of the stuff that I put in the cipher was from some FBI training at the FBI National Academy conference, and then some of the stuff that I put in A Different Dawn, actually some of it came from a retired Phoenix police homicide detective
oh.
I interviewed, and then some of it came from a lab director. So, you know, it's like I have to interview people and understand exactly how this would go on.
There's you know, somebody at the university is studying artificial intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and I'm trying to get all, there are a lot of acronyms in the book too.
Yeah.
AI plus ML.
Yes.
Artificial
yes.
Intel plus machine learning, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
maybe speak a little bit about
sure.
that?
Sure. That was one of the things I wanted to make sure I included, because I mean, we're all talking about AI lately, and you know how you know it's becoming more conscious, and everybody's you know concerned about that and everything. But the cutting edge is to pair it with ML, which is machine learning. And so when I was doing a deep dive and trying to study enough on that to write about it, I mean, it's like that's really what you can do to help create a construct where you would solve crime. So I
Right.
created this professor who thinks that that's how he's going to solve every problem. He's got a little bit of hubris going on, though, because he doesn't understand that human nature is not always reducible
Right.
to an equation. It's surprising how often those kind of programs can be quite accurate, but it doesn't make an investigator obsolete because human beings are endlessly fascinating and complicated and confusing.
Right. There's so many wonderful characters in here, and I can't help but ask you about this guy named, he's a psychic investigator. And
Yeah.
some of you in law enforcement, I'm sure, have had experiences with these kind of folks. Arthur Mage,
Yes.
how does he think? Well, first, let's talk about how the investigation gets going, and then how he kind of appears on the scene.
Yes, yeah. So they're called in to investigate these different disappearances. And obviously, if you can imagine that as the disappearances continue, the families are getting more and more and more riled up. And they have to have a press conference and then another press, you know, every time another young lady, these are female co-eds who are disappearing in this case. And so it gets more and more complicated and more public attention, and it starts to get wider attention. And the parents are getting desperate. And this is, I mean, I put myself in the position of a parent whose college-aged daughter, and these are all freshmen, so they're like 18, 19, have disappeared. And I just imagined how frantic, how desperate I would be. And that is exactly, you know, what these parents are going through. So they'll do anything to get answers, and they're, you know, just crazed. And so then I thought, well, you know, this will happen sometimes where someone will prey on these families. So enter the psychic detective who shows up offering his services. Yeah, his name is Arthur Mage, but that's really a stage name,
Of
we find
course,
out.
of course.
Yeah, nobody's really named Arthur Mage. But anyway, so yeah, so he shows up, and really basically he is a gold digger who is there, and he inserts himself into the investigation, and he's preying on these poor families' feelings, but he's interfering with the investigation. And I do bring this to the table, and those who are in the room who are law enforcement will know exactly what I'm talking about. When you have a major investigation going on, and then you get leads and tips and interference and public statements and things like that from people like that, it really slows things down. And I just wanted to sort of give a sense of what that's like to deal with.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to ask you, you know, we're all fascinated by procedural details, and you know how police and law enforcement and FBI operate. Is there a challenge on kind of balancing the amount of detail that you put in the book, you know, to keep from, you know, slowing the story down? And then I'm sure the reality of law enforcement is often not quite as sexy as it appears on TV.
Yeah.
How do you negotiate those kind of things?
It is, I tell you, it is really hard because I also am fascinated by the procedure and
Right.
the, and, you know, in reality, it is often a slog of getting through tons of evidence. You know, you serve a search warrant, and it takes such a long time to go through everything that's present at the
That's right.
scene, and, you know, just. And even getting the evidence together to even write an affidavit for the search warrant and then serving it and all that, it's the whole thing is really mind-bogglingly a slog. And so I try to mention all these things that need to be done without going into too much detail. And to be honest, though, sometimes I do have to go in and delete some of the stuff out because I find that I've just gone on for a couple of pages about this before I realize, and then I wake up, I'm like, oh, no, nobody wants to know that much. And, you know,
Right.
then I have to go back and take some of it out. And it's kind of painful, but I know that it needs to be done. And I think I do a pretty good job because, you know, most of the people you know, will write to me, and they won't complain that there's too much procedure or that kind of thing. So, and I know that I'm trying to write a fast-paced thriller.
Right, right.
What I write is not a leisurely character study. So, you
right.
know,
keep
there's
it,
a lot
keep
of
it moving,
exactly.
Right?
I mean, there's a lot of character development in there, but it's just at a fast pace, and you have to insert it while you keep the action going.
One of the things, kind of the writerly things that I admire that you do is that, you know, you've got this cast and crew, this team, and just by having them talking through a scene, the reader is, you give the reader all this knowledge that we need to know, you know, and it's kind of seamless the way it works, and it kind of moves the story forward.
Well, thank you. That is
yeah.
that is the dream. I mean, that's that's the goal. It's not to have the backstory. Just you just don't want to do what's called info dumps, you know,
right.
where you're just putting in chunks of, you know, and all that. You want
yeah.
it to try to come out organically, if at all possible.
I mean, we've all read those books that have the kind of real clunky, awkward dialogue where it's like, "So, Joe, tell me about the plight of the inner city." Well, funny you should ask, blah, 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 you
yeah.
know, and it's real unnatural. And so this is the part I'm kind of, I don't want to get too, give away too much spoiling kind of material, but falconry
mm-hmm. yeah.
plays a key role in this book. And ancient Egypt, you can imagine those two kind of through lines.
Yeah.
Tell okay. us about it.
What can I say about that? Yeah. Obviously, the book is called The Falcon, and the reason that it's called The Falcon is because falconry does play a very important part. I can say that the bad person, the kidnapper in the book, is obsessed with falconry. And what you know about, what you learn about falconry, for those who already know, they understand this, but for those who don't, falconry involves manipulation. You are manipulating a raptor, which is a falcon, which is a bird. If you think about it, and I actually, this is one of my quotes from the book, is that you can't beat a falcon into submission. You know, you can't whip them and get them to do what you want. That's not possible. And the only way you can work with a fierce predator, an apex kind of predator like a falcon, is you have to manipulate them. You have to sort of bend them slowly to your will. And this is what the guy does with his captives. Creepy. He's not violent physically at all. He's kind of the opposite of the Cypher. You know,
right.
The Cypher was very violent. This guy, no, it's all mind control.
Yeah. Was there any inspiration from a real life case?
No, not really per se, but what did inspire me was one of my other jobs I had in law enforcement. I was a hostage negotiator. And as a negotiator, we were trained in the Stockholm Syndrome. And we had to understand that if we were negotiating with someone to release their captive, that we had to understand there might be a circumstance where the captive didn't want to come out or was more worried about the safety of their kidnapper than they were their own safety. And so sort of being taught about Stockholm Syndrome, how that works, how when you depend on someone else for your very survival, your brain forces you as a survival technique to bond with that person. And so that's the sort of the law enforcement nexus that I used for the falconry component of it.
Right. I got to ask you about maybe some influences. You know, well, Silence of the Lambs. You know, when we think about a, you know, a female FBI lead, we automatically think about Clarice Starling. You know, and Harris really kind of created this template in some ways. And this is for you guys in law enforcement too. A question: are there that many Hannibal Lecters out there?
Well, when I was talking to the behavioral analysis unit people, I remember one of them commented that they thought that at any given time there may be as many as 40 serial killers operating in the United States at any
wow.
given moment, which sounds like a horrible amount.
Oh,
it does, but I mean, there are 300 million people, you know, 330 million people, but That's still a scary amount, and many of them, unfortunately, do go uncaught for a long period of time. So for that reason, I don't know how accurate you can say that is, because the ones that are actively out there, we don't know who they are,
right,
and we aren't sure how many there are, because many times, you know, victims simply do disappear, and we don't know what happened to them. We don't know if they were killed or if they had an accident or if they got lost. I mean, we honestly don't know. So, and that was another sort of impetus to make this start off with just disappearances.
Right, right. And there's, you know, one of the things I was going to bring up is that there's, and it definitely plays into this book, I won't give you details, but there's this ritualistic kind of fetish-driven thing that a lot of these serial killers, or some of them have, you know, and where the crime scenes are very staged. They're almost trying to create this work of art in some twisted way. Mm-hmm. Have you found that to be
well? This
the
is
case?
Something that actually, the first his name is John Douglas, and yeah, he really coined the term about signature. And this is, you know, a long time ago. He was one of the first ones, the first FBI, you know, profilers, criminal
mind
profilers. Yes, Mindhunter. Exactly,
yeah,
right. That's who that is. And he was someone who actually studied these crime scenes, and he was the one who coined that term. So you have, you know, you have someone who has a method, and then you have someone who has a signature, and they're not the same thing, because the signature doesn't necessarily help them get the crime committed. It's just something they feel compelled to do. And I've seen crime scene photos of actual victims and some of the things that are done, and it's very weird. I mean, first of all, it's disturbing, but second of all, I can't understand, you know, for example, and I think I use this as an example even in the book. I think I explain in one of my books, you know, for example, I don't understand what drawing a circle on someone's stomach would do. Like, why? And that's a signature. That's just something they feel compelled to do. It means something to them. It's doesn't help them commit the crime, but it does something inside of their own mind that they feel compelled to do it.
Right.
And that's one of the ways that you connect crimes. They could be in different cities, different states, you know, different over the years, but you can see the same. Now, there can be copycats, mm-hmm, but usually they don't get it right. They don't get exactly right. They can get close, but they don't get everything exactly right, which is one of the reasons that law enforcement, we don't release all of the details, because we're looking for that. We want to make sure that we have not got a copycat.
Did any of you see that series? I can't remember which channel it's on, but a very good true crime series about all the serial killers kind of operating in Los Angeles or in California, I think it was. You know, Ramirez, of course, and a whole bunch of different ones. And the era of the traveling serial killer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the only reason I'm bringing that up is that, kind of going back to how technology has changed the game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, back in the Bundy era, you know, it was a lot easier for these guys just to cross state lines, you know, and slip away or go
yes
to the other side of the country. And there wasn't that, you know, pooled resources. Fascinating stuff. We've come a long way in a really, seems like a really short period of time.
It has. And I mean, the FBI, they manage the VICAP database,
yeah,
which is the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program, and it's a massive database, and all of local law enforcement and state law enforcement, and they all feed data into it, and that is what sometimes can help them connect cases, because they see those signatures, like what we were talking about, and they can tell, oh, this is the same kind of, this looks like the same thing we saw over here in Florida, but now we see it, you know, in Seattle or something. And yeah, it makes it a lot harder for them to get away from it.
Right. And we're, you know, those of us who are in civilian life, you know, we're led to believe that there's always this conflict between
mm-hmm
the feds and the, you know, local law enforcement. And then another wrinkle comes into this book, which is campus police forces.
Mm-hmm.
How does that all kind of work?
Yeah, it's kind of fun. I had a lot of fun with that. I mean, campus police, they are...
are they rent-a-cops or
no,
are they
they're sworn
legit
law enforcement. They actually have law enforcement powers on campus. They're sworn law enforcement and things like that, but their jurisdiction is limited to the campus, and then the types of crime that they investigate, you know, pretty much. I mean, when it's just And that's why I have it start with the campus police. Like when it just starts where they just have some girls that didn't come back from, you know, one didn't come back from fall or winter break. And then, you know, other ones, and I kind of made it deliberately ambiguous in the beginning. They weren't sure, you know, did she just run off with her boyfriend because she's done it before?
Right.
You know, campus police are handling that because it's just a kid that didn't show up to class. You know, it doesn't seem
Vegas like, somewhere.
Very, exactly. And so it isn't until it starts gaining more and more momentum. And then, okay, you know, at that point, you know, they're going to call and ask for some help for the FBI just to make sure that, you know, there isn't this stuff going on. Then when a body turns up, that's when the Phoenix Police Department gets involved, because now you have a murder that is, and I made sure that it was within, you know, the city limits, and so now you have a murder that's being investigated, and that is not the purview of the FBI, and it is not the purview of the campus police. It wasn't on campus, and, you know, so now you get multiple levels, and it is, I did want to kind of show how that will happen, and everybody has to work together. You have to. You have to put aside whatever differences. I made it, and this actually happens quite a lot. I made the lieutenant in charge of the campus police, I made him a retired Phoenix police detective. Because it happens a lot. You know, people will retire from a big city police department like Phoenix, and they'll take a job on a major college campus and, you know, in law enforcement there. And that,
right.
You know, so that was totally believable that that would occur. And so that is what I did. And, but then, you know, but he kind of had an axe to grind because he didn't leave in a happy place. He was kind of angry when he left.
Right.
So he was not happy to see his old, you know.
Are there certain little kind of subtle stories like that and little bits of humor that just like your close friends and colleagues will go, oh yes,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's some inside baseball there that people in law enforcement would appreciate more. But I think there's enough of, you know, where it's human nature, and you'd be like, okay, I can get why, okay, this guy left kind of under a cloud. He's kind
right.
of not happy with the Phoenix Police Department at the moment because, you know, what happened. But then you realize, you know, he did some stuff that wasn't right. And so, you know, that's why. And, you know, anyway, yeah.
And you do the classic, kind of the classic from a point of view standpoint, you know, going back and forth between your team, and then we get the chapters that are from our killer or our perpetrator's point of view. Are those challenging?
Oh yeah.
Are they fun?
Yeah, they're fun. They're fun and challenging. I really do. As a matter of fact, one reviewer just today was commenting that he really likes my books because he really likes a really, really dark bad guy. And so I'm like, yeah, you know, I do too, you know, because that really, if you don't have a worthy adversary, then it doesn't really challenge your main character to kind of show what they're worth or to show their stuff. And so I guess because I've seen a lot of things, I do go dark sometimes with these things. And, you know, in this, and like I said, in this particular one, it's much more psychological to me. You know, like I said, the cipher was just pretty brutal, and but this one is just it's so creepy, but totally in a mental way, and I really, you know, I like to do that.
And of course, we have one of the characters in the book here with us this evening, one Dr. Ledford.
Yes, Dr. Ledford makes an appearance. Yeah, she appears. I think in all three books. I think.
Yeah.
I think the whole series we have Dr. Ledford. Yeah.
And also, I wanted to ask you. There's a Dr. Pendergast.
Yeah.
In this, was that a slight nod to Preston and Child, or were you thinking about them at all?
No. That
okay.
was strictly not.
I thought it might have been because they've dealt with some Egypt stuff
yes.
in their books. I'm thinking
yeah.
it's just kind of a side wink.
No, but that's really clever, and I might take credit for that in the future. Now I'm on the record.
Oh,
but,
man, there's stuff I want to get into that I can't. I'm sorry.
I know. Well, there's, you know, there's a little bit about ancient Egypt. We can,
yeah,
you
let's,
know,
let's,
we can
let's,
talk
let's,
a little bit about that.
Let's talk a little bit about ancient Egypt.
Yeah. So this particular bad guy, also, in addition to having a fascination with falconry, he also has a fascination with ancient Egyptian culture and mythology. And so he is sort of recreating some things from that era with his crime scenes and with what he does. You know, you mentioned very ritualistic,
yeah.
and that is some of the rituals that are involved with that. So
right.
yeah.
Did talk about the research. Did you have fun kind of going in deep dig on these subjects?
The research was amazing, and I do research probably way too much. But after I had the first draft, actually probably even the second draft written, you know, so I knew kind of where the story wanted to go, I found an Egyptologist, and I sent her the book, the manuscript, and she went through and made sure I had gotten most things right, but there were some things that she's like, no, not quite, you know, and I made sure that I got this, that, and the other thing right. And it was so funny. Because at one point, and she's so cute, but at one point she said, you know, people are going to know this right away. And it was like, it was some obscure Egyptian god or goddess. And I'm thinking to myself, no, you're an Egyptologist. It's obvious to you.
A handful of fellow Egypt nerds would know it, but that's about it.
It was really cute. I left it in there, you know, because I'm thinking, okay, all right.
So a few people, yes, that's it,
Mott. She thought, oh, everybody knows who Mott is. Does everybody know who the goddess Mott is? No, I didn't either until I started studying for this, you know, so don't feel bad. But she's like, oh, everyone's going to know who Mott is. And I'm like, no, but it's okay. But she's lovely. And as a matter of fact, I acknowledged her in the book for helping me to make sure I got the facts straight. Because it takes someone with that kind of scholarly level to, you know, to me anyway, I try to research everything as much as I possibly can. My husband will attest to this fact that I go way too far with it and try to get everything absolutely perfect. But even when you do that, you can't always reach the level of someone who has spent decades studying their subject. And I'm just so grateful that they were willing to do it. So yeah, the ancient Egyptian stuff that you find in there is spot on, thanks to her.
And there's a scene where Nina goes up to, I think it's like Cave Creek or Carefree, to meet with a falconer.
Oh yeah, it's the oh gosh, where is it? I know, I'm asking my husband.
We used to have somebody that worked for the Poison Pen Press that was a falconer.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh,
I can't remember her name.
There is a falconry society in Phoenix, and they went up to the game and fish. That's what it is. The Game and Fish. They have their own headquarters up there. And I forget where it is. I haven't read the manuscript in a few months, so I forgot. It's where? Carefree Highway. Okay, there it is. Carefree Highway. So yeah, it's outside the city.
And some of the little details, you know, about falcons, you know, snatching their prey in midair.
Yes.
Just a lot of fun, you know.
Yeah, they do that, and they use them all over the place for that purpose. They've started using them to take down drones and to, you know, to make sure that people don't get into trouble with drones. I don't want to say too much about that part, but yes. And but the falconers spend a lot of time working with their birds and caring for them, and it's like you have to be an apprentice for a year and stuff before you're even allowed to have a bird.
A master falconer.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I wish I could remember her name. But it was different kinds of birds, not just falcons. And she brought in an owl, which is super cool to see an owl up close, you know, this big old owl. Yeah, very neat. I'll open it up to questions in just a second. But the last thing I wanted to bring up was Veranda Cruz, of course, you know, the protagonist of the first three books. I kept thinking, all right, we're in Phoenix. There's going to be like a walk-on where she'll walk, you know, that kind of thing.
That'd be fun.
When you're thinking about this, do you consider that they're in the same world, like in the same city, and they're on the same streets, or does that really factor into the equation?
No, I really don't. It's you know, different publishers, so totally different,
gotcha.
And so I don't, you know, have any
all rights reserved
crossover. Exactly. I don't have any crossover going on, but, you know.
Veranda Cruz could walk by.
You think?
No. But also just the fact that what's kind of cool about this particular novel is the campus. And it is sort of a form of a locked room by extension. You know, all right, is it this guy? Is it this person? Mm-hmm. There's a limited cast of characters.
Yeah.
Was that intentional?
Yeah, and that was very different. Actually, yeah, this one is kind of a little more I don't want to say Agatha Christie because that's really a, you know, different, but it's more.
If she was really dark and twisted.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be
Agatha Christie. Yeah, if she was doing a serial killer and all that, it would be like that. But yeah, I deliberately wanted to tap into that vibe.
Yeah.
Because again, like in the first book in the series, you know, it's nationwide, it's all over the place, and then you know in the second one it is more, you know, kind of in Phoenix. But in this last one, I was trying to have it be more of like a mystery. You're exactly right, and you picked up on that. There is a limited cast of characters. You're kind of stuck in the same place, and you know it does almost have kind of that claustrophobic feeling. And most people, the overwhelming majority, have told me that they didn't guess who the perpetrator was. So I'm trying to do that as much as I can for fun, but even the like one or two people that told me that they were able to figure it out, that's good because it means I did put a couple of clues out there, and then also that it didn't detract from any enjoyment. They still enjoyed the process.
Yeah, we were talking in the back, and you know when you get to a book and the author hasn't played fair with you, you know, and you get to the end, you're like, oh bullshit, you know, we don't know who this person is. They were never shown to us. You
right.
know? That happens every once in a while.
Yeah.
And not in this case.
No.
Yeah.
No. It's, yeah. All the clues are there.
All the clues are there.
And
yeah.
You can do it, but it's going to take some head scratching.
All right. One last thing. Field notes. This particular serial killer, kidnapper, whatever you want to call him.
Yeah.
We get little snippets of these field notes as he's going along. Tell us about that. Is that a...
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with that too. That was another one. I was, you know, in the middle of writing and I'm thinking about this person and the kind of personality who would be the type that would want to, you know, train or something like that. And I thought, you know what? This person would keep notes. They would want to document. And he has a meticulous personality, so would want to document every little thing that went on. And it just popped into my head. I'm like, field notes, that would be cool. What if you had a book where you would actually have what looked like a sheet of handwritten field notes? And I got a hold of my publisher and asked them if they'd be willing to do it. And they're like, yeah, go ahead and like rough it out for us and tell us, you know, kind of what you have in mind. And I was so happy they were willing to do it. So now I'm thinking this adds a lot of fun to it in the book. I understand on the Kindle version, it's a little hard to read. You have to, you know, try to expand them and make them bigger. But in the paperback version, they're, you know, they are perfect.
Yeah.
But they show up really well, you know, where you have these creepy field notes where you can flip through and you'll find them. There's some creepy field notes, and they did such a great job of making those come to life. So
it
that
puts
you,
the lotion in the basket. Or it gets the hose. No, just kidding.
Not at all. But yeah, I had fun with that.
Yeah. Let me open it up to questions. I was afraid of this.
Oh, no. We got Kate. One.
When you do all that research, what do you, what rituals do you go through not to do more research than you need? You know, because once you get into it, you go, oh, yeah, that's cool. I want to include that.
It's true.
And then you got to, like, put it down.
It's a rabbit hole, as we say. Yeah, you do. And especially, I mean, something as wonderful and fascinating as ancient Egyptian culture, that's fascinating. I mean, you can easily spend days on end just lost in that. And I did a couple times, you know, spend too much. I got to the point where I had to start setting an alarm for myself to snap me out of it after like a half an hour. It's like if I haven't, you know, I need to snap out of it and get up and walk around because otherwise, you know, it never, I mean, people think about it. They spend decades, they, you know, their whole career is spent on that stuff. So yeah, I did learn a lot more than what's in there. And so what happens is, you know, dump everything in there, and then I take a step back and say, okay, this is kind of slowing the pace. And that's, unfortunately, I have to keep the reader turning pages. And so I'm like, okay, I've got to take this out. I've got to take that out. You know, I mean, I was at the point where I was learning fascinating things about how they actually built the pyramids and what the theories are, because nobody's sure. And, you know, and some of that shows up in the book, but not much. I mean, I had a whole lot. And then I'm like, okay, we just need a couple things about the pyramids, and then we got to just cut it, you know. But it's hard because I love learning. You know, I'm curious. And I think a lot of readers are the same way. That's one of the reasons I love readers, is because readers are smart, curious people.
And some of the details are so weird, I'm sure you just
yeah,
can't resist keeping them in.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, some things. Anything else?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming with field notes over from the killer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it takes you to the dark place to get into those, into the mind of a killer like that.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you then exit? When you get yourself into that mindset and you're writing from this perspective in that really dark place, then how do you get out of it?
You know, it reminds me, well, exactly. And it's kind of funny because, you know, people have asked my husband how he sleeps at night.
One eye open?
That's what he says. That's his answer. It's like, my goodness. Yeah, some of that stuff is dark. Actually, you know what? At the end, when I'm done writing for the day, I'll come out and I'll tell my husband. I'm like, okay, you know, I'm done for the day. And then we try to just... we change the subject, we talk about other things, and usually, especially right before bed, we try to watch something funny, something humorous, to lighten it up right before bed, you know? Because even the news is depressing, and so it's like, we can't even do that right before bed, so I'll deliberately try to see something that makes me laugh, and that is, because you're right, in this sense, it's a little bit, but some of these skills I did learn when I was in law enforcement. As a cop, you have to learn to try to wash some of that stuff off of yourself mentally when you come home and you deal with your family, so that you're not, you know, smearing it all over your family too. So I already had some of those skills, yeah, and now I just, you know, continue with that. Yeah. Glass of wine, yeah. Afterward. Exactly.
Well, Nina's backstory is so intense too.
It is.
And that's a super dark place to go. Yeah. And then Bianca's in this new book also.
Yeah.
Almost darker than the killer, really.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah, it kind of is. It kind of is, which is why, you know, but that's how they bonded, is because,
right.
And that's why, you know, Bianca is like the kid sister that Nina never had. And, you know, that's why she cares about her so much.
And we learn a little bit more about it in these books, which we can't talk about. But, about why she's emotionally unavailable and all these
exactly.
kind of things. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is. It's true. Yeah.
So what's up with J-Lo and all that good stuff?
Ah, well, I'll have to call her and ask.
Yeah.
Nope, she's not on speed dial yet. I'm joking, but it's, I don't know. I think right now she's filming some other things. So I don't know where I am in the hopper. We have to wait and see, but so far so good. I figure no news is good news.
A lot was on hold the last couple of years too, right? Everything was halted.
A backlog and stuff like that. So
exciting.
I don't know. It is. It's extremely exciting.
Yeah.
It really is. Just great.
So this was this is completing a trilogy, I understand it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the first series was all a trilogy as well.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing next?
Okay, so right now I am working on the first book of a new series. It's called A Killer's Game, and it is going to be out next May. And it features an FBI agent named Daniela Vega, and it's all set in New York City. But she is not a profiler. It's not a serial killer story. It's totally different. The kind of crime. Actually, she works out of the New York JTTF.
Translation.
I know it's another acronym. All the cops in the room know what that is. Yes, that's the Joint Terrorism Task Force is what JTTF stands for. The FBI's they started setting them up, and actually the one in New York City was the very first one in the entire United States. It was established in 1980, and so they. investigate any kind of major terrorist thing. And it was so successful because it's a task force and it involves state, local, and federal law enforcement to bring to force, I mean, to bring to bear all of these different kinds of law enforcement when they're investigating a major crime that involves terrorism or anything that has a nexus with terrorism. And it was so incredibly successful that they ended up, that now virtually every FBI location has a JTTF in it. And it's just New York City was the first, and it's the largest. And the one in New York City has, I think there's like 2,000 people who work out of that, 61 different agencies. It's
was that a
massive.
Post-9/11 kind of construction?
It got bigger. I mean, it started in 1980, so way before that. But it got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then after 9/11, it just exploded in size. And they investigate things that are, you know, even in other parts of the world, and it's really impressive what they do. And so that is where she works out of this. It's not necessarily a terrorist investigation that she gets involved with, but that's kind of her job. And, you know, she's there in New York City, and she's pretty cool, I have to admit. I it's kind of hard because I love Nina so much, but Danny is very cool too. She's awesome. She's very cool.
Awesome. Great. Anybody else have some questions, or? Did you have some goodies that you wanted to give away?
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Or
yes.
How would you like to do that?
Yeah. Usually we make people ask or make people answer a question. I don't know. Do you have any ideas? Mike, my husband, my charming husband, got these. So.
Yeah.
We are. Warrior Girl. This is for the Warrior Girl. I did.
Very cool.
I do calligraphy, so I put calligraphy on here. I signed it, and this one's for the Cipher, A Different Dawn and the Falcon. So I guess what we're going to do is... it says Warrior Girl in the back. So I was thinking maybe a trivia question from each one of the books. So I mean, it's kind of not fair for the Falcon, but we'll see what we can come up with for the Falcon. But anyway, so for the Cipher, I'm thinking. Let's see. I was coming up with a trivia question. I don't want to make it too hard, but
you could also do like a law enforcement question. So anybody who's in law enforcement can't answer the question.
Can't answer it, but
something that all the civilians might have access
they
to.
They can whisper the answers to them or whatever. Gosh. Let's see. I had something in the... what was it? What is... Special Agent Breck is a member of the team, and there is a certain place that she's familiar with that plays into the Cipher. It's what is the city where she's from that has the main clue in it? It's Breck's hometown, and it involves, they find a major clue there. It's a big city down south. Nobody remembers? I'll give you a hint. The Waving Girl statue. Oh, yeah. Oh, my. No.
Mm-mm. Nolens?
This one's a port city. In Georgia.
Oh.
Yes, Savannah, you win. Is this the lady from New York?
Yes.
And you win, Savannah? Yes. Awesome, very good. Yes, very cool. All right, so, okay, now I gotta think of one that came from A Different Dawn. Okay, so let's see, this one's in Phoenix. So I'm trying to think of some Phoenix trivia from A Different Dawn. That would be fun since we're all here in Phoenix. All right, remember how this went. I'll get my husband to do a regular Phoenix trivia question. And if you can't, I'll make Tim Moore do it if you can't. A regular Phoenix trivia question to test someone's knowledge of the streets of Phoenix. or the city of Phoenix. Doesn't necessarily have to do with a Different Dawn is all set in Phoenix, the whole thing. So
can it be like
about Phoenix.
Older?
Yeah, like old school trivia from Phoenix.
Who can tell me where Madison Square Gardens was located?
Oh,
yeah. 7th Avenue, just below Van Buren.
Ding, 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 ding.
Oh, Kate. Okay, there you go. You get a Different Dawn. There you go. All right. Now.
Called her own ballroom. Where was it now?
Ah, thank you for
Riverside.
That. Thank you for that. Very cool.
Not to snatch all your questions.
No, really. I was not even thinking about this yet. Okay, so the last one. The Falcon's also set in Phoenix, so we could do another Phoenix trivia question. If anybody, do you have one, either one of you two, especially? You two know more about Old Town Phoenix. Where is the Phoenix Courthouse? The original.
The old school one, yeah.
Okay, it's got to be harder then. Kate is on it.
Winnie Ruth Judd was tried there and everything, yeah. Oh, Winnie Ruth Judd was tried there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great building.
Wow. Okay. All right. You got to come up with another one. Kate can't have two swords.
How about a good cop restaurant? Cop restaurants. What's a good cop restaurant?
Anybody know where Durant's is?
Of course.
That's a restaurant. Central Land.
Central, Virginia, right?
Say Virginia.
Where's Carolina's Mexican joint?
Mojave and 7th Street. There you go. All right. You get the Falcon. That's right.
Sorry to hijack your questions.
No, I needed something. I'm like, okay. All right. So that's always fun.
Yeah.
And then what we'll do is, you know what? We can, I don't know, we don't have any numbers or anything to draw.
We have, you know, if you bought a book,
do we?
Okay. You'll have a numbered ticket. Yeah.
We'll do, yeah. We'll do that. And we have these lovely feather boas. And actually the feathers kind of play into the story of the Falcon. These feathers. So we have a couple of feather boas to give away, but I need to get a number to draw. Or should I just say a random number? I don't know between what and what. I don't know. But I'll just make it.
Sure.
I'll just make it like a low number. What we'll do then when we're done, so someone can have this lovely boa, and then they'll understand when they read the book how feathers play into it and why they're important. Feathers. Okay. All right. So that's it. We'll do that when we're done.
Yeah, let's break up and have you sign some books for us.
Okay.
And thanks everybody for watching online too.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.